Well, we've got a great chapter, certainly one of my favorite chapters in the whole story, and I hope I may do it justice in the time that we have. Genesis chapter 48. And if I wanted a New Testament verse just to give the keynote, which Robert really has already given to tonight's theme, it would be Acts 4:28. Acts 4:28, let me just read it, and then we'll stay in Genesis 48. Starting in the middle of verse 27, this is part of the prayer of the disciples to God. Verse 24 of Acts 4, they lifted up their voices to God and said, "Sovereign Lord, for truly in this city there were gathered together against thy holy servant Jesus, whom thou didst anoint, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever thy hand and thy plan had predestined to take place." It's one of the grandest statements of the confidence of the early church in the sovereignty of God, that in fact whatever Herod and Pontius Pilate did, all that happened was what God had planned to be done. So back then to Genesis 48. I'm always thankful that when I went to Amsterdam to see some pictures in 1969, I'm sorry if you're bored with the story of pictures I've seen in Holland, but I happened to coincide with the 300th anniversary of Rembrandt's death. And I think I'm right. Don't quote me right if I'm wrong there. And I saw the great picture from Kassel, which is in, I think, East Germany, and therefore very difficult to see, of Jacob's blessing. And it's certainly one of the great Rembrandt pictures in the world. And there he's caught something of the wonder of the scene as the very old man, who already we've been told several times is about to die, lays his hand on the two little boys' heads as they stand there by his bedside. And we come to the heart of the story, of course, in verse 17, that when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he took his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. As I said at the beginning of the story, Joseph is by no means the hero, although everything that he has shown so far shows his wisdom and his submission to God. Here he's definitely upset and wants to alter what his father is doing. And Joseph says to his father, "I don't want you to do that, father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your hand upon his head, your right hand." But his father refuses and says, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people. He also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he." So here is one more of the classic cases in Genesis of the first being last and the last first. It happened, of course, with Jacob himself. It's happened with Joseph because he wasn't the firstborn, but as verse 5 makes very clear, he's become the firstborn because he's given a double portion. His two sons will become heads of tribes in the future. So verse 5 is implicitly saying that Joseph has been made the firstborn in the place of Reuben, who, you remember, slept with his father's concubine and had been in permanent disgrace since. So Joseph is made the first when he might well have been the last, and now Ephraim and Manasseh, or rather Ephraim is made first when he was the last. So you've got a wonderful picture here, a very clear picture in the story of the free grace, the sovereign grace of God, with Jacob upset that God has chosen quite differently than the order of nature. Now, this is not anything arbitrary on the part of the old man. I suppose, being an old man, he might well have made a mistake. But in fact, the story rams it in by showing in verse 5, long before he did this, Ephraim, you see, is put before Manasseh, and what is said there, "Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine." And then afterwards, in verse 20, again, to make it quite clear, he pronounced on them a blessing, "God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh." So the story is telling us perfectly plainly that this choice was made willingly by Joseph as a mark of God's choice. Now this upsets Joseph, done by Jacob, it upsets Joseph, and it upsets him naturally. But there's no more argument after his father has said that this is the choice that he wants, because of course to Joseph, as we have learnt already, God's choice is final. And he submits to it. I think this wonderful story, this wonderful illustration of God choosing at the end, as he chose at the beginning, how the line was to go on, fits very well to this story's theme. This is a God-centered story. And in the guidance, as we've read about it in this story, we've been reading not about man making choices in a very complicated story, but we've been reading about God making choices. Now, this God making choices, this business of election, always produces uneasiness in people and frowns, just as it did with Joseph. He didn't like it. He probably felt it was rather unfair and went and told his wife so. And we feel directly this issue of election and choice is brought up, that it's rather regrettable that it should be associated with God. We immediately get rather hung up on whether man has left any freedom. Of course, the difficulty is that if you believe in free will, as so many Christians seem to do today, well, then you don't leave God any freedom. Who's going to have the ultimate freedom? Well, actually, you can't finally answer this except in experience. But the more you go on in the Christian life and in your understanding of the Bible, you see that God's freedom and God's choice is the uppermost fact in the author's mind all the time. And old-fashioned Christians in the 18th century and earlier than that used to call this God's free grace. So let me just for a moment define what we're going to talk about tonight. Grace means God's love and mercy towards those who don't deserve it at all. And that means all of us. We're the recipients of God's love. He loves us simply because he loves us. And again in the Old Testament, Israel was told that God had chosen them not because they were good, that certainly wasn't true, or because they were numerous, that certainly wasn't true. But, and I love the logic of the verse in Deuteronomy, God loved you because God loved you. That's all you can say. The reason for God's love is to be found within God himself, and he hasn't revealed to us why his love is given in a special way to some and not to others. And that leads me on to say that his grace and love is free. That means that he can give his freedom, his grace, just to whoever he wants. Now, this humbles us, of course. The only illustration that I can use, as I've used several times, I think, before, is of a headmaster. Here you've got a headmaster with a comprehensive school in South London with 3,025 pupils. Now, if that headmaster is going to act in any way, he's got to take into account five different people. He's got to think of the 3,025 pupils, so probably they won't rise very high in it all. He's got to think of the Old Pupils Association, who happen to have a very tough political leader and the chairman of the Urban District Council. He's got to think of the governors and the local education authority. He's got to think of the staff room, who are always up in arms, whatever he does. And he's got to think of the parents, who also happen to be very vocal at this particular time. So as he signs his 20th letter in the morning, or the notice that's going to go up on the 55 boards around the school to say what the headmaster wishes, he turns to his secretary and he says, I wonder which one is going to object this time. Every time he does this, he's conscious of five people pressuring on him and saying, you can't do that there, yeah. Now, does God feel any pressure of this kind? If he did, it would be a pretty awful thing, wouldn't it? If there were certain special Christians who could lay hold of God so that you and I had to do what they wanted. If, in other words, Christianity was a form of magic where you could use certain powers and charms by which you might manipulate God, then we should be very unhappy people if we realized that God wasn't free to be God. So that, surprisingly, this old-fashioned, rather reformed doctrine of free grace turns out to be the happiest doctrine in the Bible. It tells us that God alone is free to do exactly what he likes. And that's a very lucky thing for us, because God is a God of grace. In other words, he's free, unlike ourselves, because we are sinful, he's free to be himself. So this is a very happy doctrine. It's also, of course, a very humbling doctrine, because it leaves us guessing. We can't follow God all the way. We don't know why he does all that he does, and that very much irritates us, especially a 20th century man who likes to know the reason for everything. Now, this is very important. It's very important because God acts in free grace sometimes in our lives in a way that leaves us stunned and bewildered, in a way that leaves us asking the question why, and nobody, not even the vicar at home, can give us the answer. Not even the most spiritual Christian can always add up all the two and twos and give us the answer to the sum and say, this is why God did that. I think, for example, of our host at the weekend at Fairmile, where some of us have been this weekend and had a wonderful time. Some of you may know Colonel Tony Kimpton, whose daughter Trish ran into the back of a lorry some years ago with her fiancé, both very attractive people, just engaged, with a great future in front of them. And as a result of that, was in a coma in UCH for a great many months. As you know, Colonel Kempton, he won't mind me saying that he's a very dominant personality. Alan Parker told me that he thought he was what the old empire builders used to be like today. Apparently he'd seen a television program on Mallory and Irvin last night, which was full of 80-year-old empire builders. He said, you know, that's rather like Colonel Kempton. Well, Colonel Tony Kempton started a prayer support for Trish at the time, which was rather like a military operation. Several secretaries worked on these letters, which were sent out to Christians all over the world to pray for her. That was a very natural and a very right thing to do. But this went on and on and on. More and more people were asked to pray, and he himself, as he told me afterwards, got more and more frustrated and unhappy. Why wasn't God doing what he was asked? Until Captain Godfrey Buxton, whom some of you may know through the Officers' Christian Union, who lives down in Camberley, wrote him a letter and said, are you sure that you're not telling God what to do? Isn't it better to submit to his sovereignty and then find happiness and relief and peace? It's just one of those letters that happened to come just at the right time and fell on his desk, and Tony Kempton has often said to me that that letter was the thing that enabled him to see that he was going about it entirely the wrong way. He was marshalling people to pray to tell God what to do. And God is the one who chooses what he will do. He's a God of free grace, said we can trust him. And in this case, he chose to take Trish to himself. But from the moment that letter came onto her father's desk, the parents were at peace. I can certainly remember that. Before that, it was desperate to meet them, because they were straining. After that, they were peaceful, even though, of course, very sad. I remember Mr. Llewellyn Roberts, some of you may know him, he's a mighty warrior, telling me going to Keswick once as a speaker, or a leader of a house party, or something of this kind, and a member of the house party was a very remarkable woman, Christian worker. I'm not sure whether she worked overseas or not. And she was miserably unhappy in the house party, and they went off for a walk. And there was nothing that Mr. Roberts could say to help her. So they walked and walked and walked and walked, as you can do in the Lake District, and they sat down tired at the end of the walk, and they were completely silent. Mr. Roberts had given all the 35 bits of advice on the walk that he was intending to give, and none of them had been in the least help. And they sat down on a rock, looked at the view, and decided to come back, and just as they were getting up, this good lady hit the rock on which she was sitting and said, I've got it. And it turned out, I won't tell you what it was, because I think you would laugh, and I don't want you to laugh at this juncture. It was quite a trivial thing in her own life that God has put his finger on and asked her to alter. And she'd been saying all the week, Lord, this is ridiculous. One of the rules of the Bible is faithful in a little, faithful in much. Do what God tells you in a small thing, and God will promote you to do things in big places. And she put this right, and she was completely happy again. What I'm leading up to is to say this, that when you grasp that God is a God of free grace and that God is the one who's calling the score, God is the one who's making the choices, God is the one taking the initiative and saying the way in which things are going to go, once you've reckoned on that, the only sensible Christian response is to submit to it. And since we were born rebels against God, and since the grace of Christ never entirely eradicates this rebellion in our hearts, however long we live the Christian life, it's a very important lesson to learn. And occasionally in our lives, as I've discovered, God seems to take a particular issue to teach us to break that will of ours again, so that we say, yes, Lord, your way. Easy to say this from the pulpit, very difficult to recognize those times and actually to do it. Now, of course, to the world, it would be a horrifying thing to realize that God was going to have his way. Absolutely, if you're not on his side. But that's what the doctrine of the second coming says. It says that when Christ appears, and we were studying this morning at Fairmile, all that is going to survive is the Church of Jesus Christ, those who've done his will. Everything else will be consumed in the wrath of God. It's a terribly important thing to realize that God is going to have the last word, because God has had the first word. And at first, before I get to know God, when I have suspicions that he's not quite the God that the Christians make out, I naturally rebel against this. That's why a real understanding of God's free grace, the happiness of believing in God, is essential if I'm really to submit to his sovereign will. Sovereign grace and free grace is only acceptable when I come to know the kind of God I'm talking about. So I thought that this little story tonight put this very well, and it's very interesting that in the context of the story, we're given the understanding why Jacob, that is Israel, I'm sorry I keep getting these names wrong, Jacob is the same as Israel, he's become Israel, and we'll see that in a minute why he is so calm in his old age and willing to do God's will, when, if you remember, ironically, when he'd gone to his father to get the blessing, it had been a lot of scheming and dishonesty and cheating. Now, how had Jacob come to this understanding that it was worth trusting God? And I felt that the answer that this chapter gave was in verses 15 and 16. And I love this answer. It's really all I've got to say tonight. I think it's a very important truth. How can I get to that state where I'm really willing to submit to God in my daily life and let God be God? Incidentally, whether I do that or not, of course, he's going to be God. It's only that he'll take a little longer to get there. Like the 40 years they were in the wilderness for a journey that takes 11 days. It's a great pity if you spend 40 years in your life getting 11 days worth. Now, the answer is by looking back. And that's what he does. I've got to be very honest here. While you look at verse 15 and 16 of Genesis 48, I think you want to squint at the same time to Genesis 47, verse 9. Because there's a double testimony here, which if it didn't appear in the same two chapters of the Bible, the theologians and the scholars would say this was another of the many contradictions in the Bible. Genesis 47, verse 9. This priceless interview between Pharaoh and the old man, who's quite clear that who's the boss, and is holding forth to Pharaoh about what life's all about. And Pharaoh says to him, verse 8, how many are the days of the years of your life? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their sojourning. That's a pretty gloomy testimony, isn't it? I've lived very few years, and they've been very bitter ones. I'm certainly not going to attain what my father Abraham and Isaac did. That's one testimony. Now turn over the page and see the other testimony. Genesis 48, verse 15. And he blessed Joseph. He's actually blessing the lads, of course, but this is said because the two lads come under their father's authority. He blessed them and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has led me all my life long to this day, the angel, that is the manifestation of God in human form in the Old Testament, who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and in them let my name be perpetuated. What a testimony! And what a testimony compared with Genesis 47, verse 9. Now, can you honestly bring these two together, or have you got to say that somehow the storyteller's got muddled up? I think, actually, that you can put the two together. Now, I think that anybody, as they grow older in the Christian life, and as they look back, can see elements of both these things, and I want to touch on both of them. First of all, he can see elements of sorrow and trial and difficulty. It is quite untrue to say that if we become Christians, life will be rosy and a primrose path. In fact, God often takes his people through many sorrowful and trying times, as he certainly had done with Joseph, and I'm sorry, with Jacob. And it was quite reasonable for Jacob to say, few and evil have been the days of my life. For example, in this chapter that we're at, chapter 48, there's that little telling statement in verse 47 where he seems to be caught up for a moment in the past. Rachel, to my sorrow, died in the land of Canaan. That never failed to make him realize something of the sorrow of the past. And he seems to have to pull himself together again to carry on with the duty he has in front of him in verse 8. So there was, and had been, in Jacob's life, a good deal of sorrow. Now why? Well, if we go back, we shall find that he'd been given the name of Jacob, and this accurately described his character, as Esau very bitterly said, in Genesis 27, verse 36. Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. And Jacob means supplanter, but I think the Living Bible rather better puts cheater. Cheat. Is he not rightly named the cheat? For he's cheated me twice now. As I say, it's very ironic that this man, Jacob, who cheated his own father out of the birthright, and then God came into that evil situation, overruled it, to see that his purposes were fulfilled, when he comes to the end of his life, no longer wants to act in that kind of way. Now, I think one of the reasons that we found that this old man, Jacob, was really rather a trial in some ways to his sons, when they came back and tried to persuade him to go down to Egypt. You remember how full of self-pity he was. You've taken one son, now you're going to take the other. I'm having a rotten time, and you're going to bring me down to my grave with grey hairs and sorrow. I think that kind of self-pity often hits people who scheme and don't trust. It's awfully interesting how when you have a theme in your mind, it keeps coming back. I was talking to a Christian woman at the weekend. She was telling me about her mother. Her mother is a Christian. She's saying that mother is so full of self-pity. And then later on in the conversation, she was saying how her mother and father, though they're Christians, simply couldn't trust God over the matter of selling their house and buying another one. And they both worried about it from morning till night. Of course, it is a very worrying thing, selling and buying a house at the moment. Now, I thought this was very interesting. She actually used the word scheming. She said, my mother lies in bed trying to rest, scheming how she's going to do it. And was full of self-pity. And I thought immediately of Jacob. There was Jacob scheming. How am I actually going to get God's blessing? How am I going to get the best out of life? How am I going to deceive Isaac? How am I going to get the better of Esau? And so he does all these things at the beginning of the story, and it's a particularly unpleasant bit of work when he first starts out on his life. And the result of that is that in Jacob's life there's an awful lot of self-pity. The wonderful thing, of course, in his life, as you'll know if you've read it, is how God constantly appears to him to break him down and to change him and to alter him. If, therefore, we rebel against God, what happens is that God has to meet us again and again and to chasten us, to break us, to show us how miserable a way it is to disobey him, even in small things. As we go on in the Christian life, God will sometimes take us up with quite small things. And then God will sometimes, if we go on, as Jacob did, allow us to meet our match. And Jacob met his match in Laban, who was just as dirty a dog as he was, you remember. And after 7 years of service, gave him the wrong woman for a wife. I often go back to that story, because it's so characteristic of God. One so often meets Christians today who seem to have been spoilt in their youth, and you say, what on earth is God going to have to do with this person? We certainly can't cope with them. Surely Isaac must often have thought that about Jacob. He must often have thought, well, he's got the blessing, but I don't know what God's going to do with him. The answer to that was 20 years on Laban's farm. 20 years. Do you remember Moses? Moses smiting down the Egyptians, saying, I realize what God wants to do. He wants to deliver these people. I've had a university education. I'm full of zeal for the Lord. There's that Egyptian. I'll go and smite him. So God says, well, you'd better go to the backside of the desert for 40 years to learn a little patience. But 40 years is a long time, isn't it? 20 years on Laban's farm must have been an awful long time. It must have been a very miserable thing to get your monthly pay packet or weekly pay packet from a man who was as great a cheat as you were and who never missed a trick. Even Jacob was at the end of his tether. You remember when he left the farm, went off, and Laban followed him, feeling that he'd been cheated. Because, of course, cheats always do feel that they've been cheated. So typical of life. So then, I think that those who find a contradiction here are just not knowing the psychology of life. Verse 9 of Genesis 47 is true to life. For a man like Jacob, who's tried to scheme his way into blessing, who's been a cheat, who's had to meet many chastenings from God, it's natural that he says at the end of this remarkable journey down, when God so simply has brought his purposes to be, no wonder he says, few and evil have been the days of my life. However, by chapter 48, he's had a chance to think again. And the more he's lived in Goshen with his son Joseph, the more he's looked back. And as he's looked back, he's begun to read the story in perspective. And he says two wonderful things about the God of his fathers, Abraham and Isaac. I think these two are two of the most thrilling things we've seen this term. First of all, in verse 15b, the God who has led me all the days of my life long. Now that word, actually, is who has shepherded me. And it's the first mention of God being a shepherd in the Old Testament. And therefore it is the forerunner of a great psalm like Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. And what Jacob is testifying here is that God has genuinely been his shepherd. And he knew a good deal about that because of the 20 years in Laban's farm. Just turn back to Genesis 31. I'm conscious that many people don't know the story, so I just want to check with you on this. I'd forgotten this bit, but it makes the remark all the more telling. This was when Laban followed him, you remember, feeling that he'd been cheated. And at last, verse 38 of Genesis 31, Jacob's really rather angry. He's done 20 years' service. He feels that's enough. And he upbraids his father-in-law. Jacob said to Laban, verse 38, what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Although you have felt through all my goods, isn't this splendid? You see, father-in-law, after 20 years, had been like an airport, whatever they're called, you know, and felt all over him and his wives. See if they were taking away things they shouldn't have taken. Although you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your she-goats have not miscarried, and I've not eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. Of my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Do you see that, Laban? Any losses? Jacob must dip into his own pocket. Which isn't the normal way that you run a farm. Thus I was, by day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've served in your house, etc., etc., etc. In other words, I've been a very good shepherd to you, to your flocks. Now with that in mind, that for 20 years, Jacob had been put on a farm by God to learn to stop cheating and scheming and start to surrender. So it's all the more moving, I think, that in verse 15 of Genesis 48, he says, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has shepherded me all my life long to this day, I want him, that God, to bless these boys. Turn over to Psalm 23. I hope you don't think Psalm 23 is for funerals and marriages only. That's an Anglican custom. Oh, I think it's a free church custom as well. You know, people know so few hymns and psalms, don't they? I remember a couple coming to be prepared for marriage and their service, and I said, well, you better choose a hymn and a psalm. So when I saw it come back from the printers, I realized they'd chosen Psalm 23 for the psalm, and they'd chosen the King of Love, My Shepherd Is for the hymn, and they hadn't realized they were the same. So we solemnly sang through them twice, and I don't suppose any of them believed any of it. That's the trouble, isn't it? It's become just a purple passage. I want you to wake up, if you're a Christian, because this really is true. Is the Lord your shepherd? If he is your shepherd, then it is true that you will not want, that he will give you the rest you need, he will restore your soul in backsliding, he will guide you, verse 3, he leads me in right paths, that's what that means. It means that he'll be with you up to suffering and death and through them. And how many of the people that you try to help in hospital honestly have that comfort? He means that in the battle of Christian work, he will enable you to face your enemies and overcome them with joy. Verse 5. And he means that goodness and mercy will follow you all the days of your life. And he means that you will dwell in his house, not only here, but forever. Do you believe that? You look pretty sad about it, some of you. Isn't that wonderful, to have the Lord as a shepherd like that? I took that on our Swiss holiday, and I think it only came to me when I taught it to others, what a wonderful thing it was to have known that in my own life, in a tiny part. And to think that not only have I known it in the past, but that this is my future, and there is no other future for a Christian. And that's why you can trust a God of free grace. Because you look back, and even if you've only been a Christian for a year, you can say, the God who has shepherded me all that year long to this day. Now, verse 16a. The angel who has redeemed me from all evil. This is the second reference to the God of the past. Jacob was specially blessed with revelations and visions of God and manifestations of angelic presences. And if you envy him, shall I tell you why he was blessed with them? Because God had such a hard job to do with him. Visions and blessings are often given to the toughest Christians because they need them most. If you learn to walk by faith, God doesn't always need to intervene in this kind of way. Let's go back to Genesis 32. This is quite the greatest of all the stories at Peniel, isn't it? I suppose this is one of the great stories of the Bible of how God breaks a man, and yet at the same time it shows how this man longed for blessing. Jacob knew that he was always doing it wrong. He knew that he was always going about it the wrong way, and yet in his heart he longed for blessing. And if you've made a mess of many things in your Christian life and yet long for blessing, this is a story for you. Verse 24, and Jacob was left alone. That was necessary for him, as it's sometimes necessary for us, isn't it? Sometimes why God takes us away from our Christian friends for a bit. Takes us out onto a lective to a hospital in Africa, perhaps for 3 months, and leaves us on our own, just dumps us there. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, yes, it was jolly difficult to overcome Jacob. Of course, this is just using the language of human beings, but God is trying to show us that Jacob was a struggler. Well, when God saw that he was going on struggling and wouldn't give in, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and immediately, of course, the battle was over. And Jacob, we should remember this incidentally, limped for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, Jacob says, I will not let you go unless you bless me. I can't go without your blessing because Esau's coming with me with an army. And I'm really out of my depth now. This is the first time in his life that he's out of his depth. Let me, I think I can't comment on it better than the words of Derek Kidner in this wonderful commentary of his on Genesis. And I think this is the most beautiful description. The conflict brought to a head the battling and groping of a lifetime, and Jacob's desperate embrace vividly expressed his ambivalent attitude to God of love and enmity, defiance and dependence. Wonder if you've got that ambivalent attitude. I've often had, I'm afraid. Love and enmity, defiance and dependence. It was against God, not Esau or Laban, that he had been pitting his strength, as he now discovered. Yet the initiative had been God's, as it was this night, to chasten his pride and challenge his tenacity. The crippling and the naming show that God's ends are still the same. He would have all of Jacob's will to win, to attain, and to obtain, yet purged of self-sufficiency and redirected to the proper object of man's love, God himself. So God wins, he captures that will, he renames him Israel instead of Jacob. After the maiming, combativeness, I can't pronounce that, had turned to a dogged dependence, and Jacob emerged broken, maimed, and blessed. His limping would be a lasting proof of the reality of the struggle. It had been no dream, and there was sharp judgment in it. The new name would attest his new standing. It was both a mark of grace, wiping out an old reproach, the cheat, and an accolade to live up to. The blessing this time was untarnished, both in the taking and in the giving. It was his own, uncontrived and unmediated. Now, my dear friends, I don't know what you think as you read that, and you read what some people say behind the covers of paperbacks today and in testimony meetings about the blessings that God has given them. It seems to me when I hear some Christians talking about the blessings that God has given them, they're so cheap. Apparently they just went and they asked God for a blessing and he gave them a blessing. Jacob didn't get his blessings like that. You don't get blessings cheaply from God. Not if you're a cheat, not if your will is hard and impenitent, not if you're rebellious, not if you're defiant, and most of us are. If you want blessings from God, you'll find that it's a costly business, and that God has to do a very great deal to humble you, and that when God gives you a blessing, it will be a blessing of sheer grace, which will be the result of a good many chastenings. It was Bonhoeffer who taught us, I think, not to believe in cheap grace. And long before Bonhoeffer ever lived and died, of course, Jacob teaches us that. Now, this teaches us, surely, and our time is up, to accept God's choice. What does that mean? As I look back into the past, I become increasingly willing to accept God's choice. That's certainly been served me. When I was a young Christian, I was very much a Jacob, very much a Jacob. I can remember doing all sorts of things and then asking God to bless them. I think the worst was a meeting I once held at Trinity Cambridge, an evangelistic meeting. I got a famous speaker. I told the Lord he got to bless it, and not one single person turned up. I think we've all known what it is to be a bit of a Jacob when we're young Christians. And the sooner we get through that painful time of being on Laban's farm and allow God to begin to shape us, the sooner we shall see that God's way is always shorter and more direct, and it's we who make the wilderness journey such a long one. And the more we look back at this and the more we experience it, the more we're willing for God to make the choices. And incidentally, the more happy we are to face the future. And I love the end of the chapter, don't you? We shall see this again next week as he faces death. But here in verse 21 of Genesis 48, "Behold, I'm about to die. God will be with you." He's lost all that peevishness and self-pity. He's now looking forward with confidence. God is going to be with you. God will be with his people. He'll bring you again to the land of your fathers. And as he says later on, "I want you to take me with you." So he's untroubled in the face of the future because he's untroubled in the face of the past. Now that's Bible philosophy, and it's a very deep philosophy. Only if you can look into the past and see the God of grace can you possibly dare to turn your head into the future and look at it. Today people don't turn into the future, do they? They don't turn the neck. They grasp desperately at the stars on Monday evening, the Evening Standard, which always has a sort of more or less optimistic view of Tuesday. Though today is not a day to make choices, or today is not a day to have too many of your friends in, or something like that. With which, of course, it's easy to agree to these pleasant pieces of advice. I love the way the Bible turns our head round and enables us to look at the future. And that's supernatural. But the Bible can only take my head to look at the future when the Bible has taken my head and made me look at the past. So the Bible philosophy is that I can live in the present and face the future if I look back to the past. That's what makes a man of faith. Turn over to Hebrews 11 and see it said there about Jacob. The only thing that's said about Jacob is a very odd verse, isn't it, in Hebrews 11:21. But I've been very, very touched by it. I think I've only understood it properly today as I've come to the end of my study of Jacob. I never understood the end of it before. Hebrews 11:21, the only thing said about Jacob, "By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph." In other words, he gave them the future. He said, "God is going to be with you, and he's going to make of you a great people." He believed about the future because he'd come to have confidence in God in the past. By the way, please notice that faith in Hebrews 11 is not a mark of man's excellence. He is not saying these men are heroes of faith, as you so often hear. They weren't heroes at all. Jacob, when he started, had no faith. He had to get all his blessings by cheating. God taught him faith over the years. So all the faith of Hebrews 11 is by grace. God taught them to have faith. God taught them to have confidence in him. And at the end of his life, even Jacob, who'd had no confidence in God at all, because that wasn't his temperament, that wasn't his way of going about it, when dying, he could have the faith to look into the future and say, "God is going to be with Joseph, and then with Ephraim and Manasseh." And then he, notice, bowed in worship over the head of his staff. It can possibly be over the head of the bed. It doesn't matter. Because what matters is that he bowed in worship. Who do you bow in worship before? Well, the sovereign, don't you? The sovereign Lord. You see how Jacob has got? The beginning, cheating his father, whisking a blessing from under the nose of God and taking it off into the country. What a nerve. What a nerve to think that you can live with God like that. "I've got it, God. You couldn't stop me." Now look him at the end of his life, blessing his sons, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. bowing, in other words, before sovereign grace. That's his testimony at the end of his life. That's why he's a hero of faith in the right sense. Because faith, that is confidence in God, which has been born through his experience, enables him to look into the future and say, the sovereign Lord will go on doing what he has been doing. Well, now I must stop. So I want to ask you a question. Have you learned to accept God's choices? Have you learned to submit? Have you learned, as a practical matter of daily life, to believe that God is a God of grace, free grace, sovereign grace, that it's futile to be his enemy, that it's happiness to submit? God is sovereign in his grace in the way you came into the world. He chose the person who would bring you into the world. If you're a Christian, he knew you before you were born. He chose your parents and your home. He chose the upbringing that you should have. He chose the friends that you should make. He chose perhaps the friends that you don't make or haven't made. He might choose even that you should live a single life. In the natural order, God's sovereign grace is always best. And we can submit to it if we believe in God, but not otherwise. In your circumstances, God also is sovereign. He's sovereign in the kind of things that have happened to you. Not only the good things, but the bad things. He's come into those things and he's dealt with them. He was sovereign in the death of Rachel, though Jacob never got over it. Doesn't mean to say we get over a thing, but God was sovereign. He was sovereign in the sin of Reuben. When Reuben sinned and lost his firstborn place, God was sovereign and brought in the person that he intended. And I think you'll get God's sovereign grace beautifully put, don't you, in verse 11. For God is not a harsh, hard taskmaster. That's what we tend to think. When we start to talk about sovereign grace, we say, well, now Dick's telling me to grit my teeth and say, yes, Lord, it's going to be grim, but you can have your way. Well, look at verse 11 then. I can't stop, you see, there's so much in this chapter, but never mind, we're going to get to the coffee. Verse 11. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them, and Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, and lo, God has let me see your children also. Is that a hard taskmaster? Isn't that lovely? I didn't expect to see you. I certainly didn't expect to see your children. And I certainly didn't know that God was going to give me the privilege of blessing them and seeing the future of the race. We have no claim on God, and it's a very happy thing for the world that it is so. We have no claim on God except his promises. These we can claim, but when we claim his promises and pray, we can know that God will answer, but still he will answer always in his own way. And if at the end of chapter 48 you're not happy about that, then this evening has been in vain. Let's pray. I dare not choose my lot. I would not, if I might. Choose thou for me, my God. So shall I walk aright. That's a grand prayer, isn't it? I'm going to suggest that in the quiet we use that prayer. You may like to turn it up if you don't remember it. Hymn 404, verse 3. But I think you will remember it and can say it in your heart. Choose thou for me, my God. So shall I walk aright. Our gracious God, you know what rebels we are at heart. Every one of us has to confess it. And ask that there is within each one of us the supplanter, the Jacob. You know that we often want great things for ourselves, that we often push ourselves and place ourselves to get things that we want, and then are hurt with you and offended when this doesn't seem to be your will. We ask you to have mercy upon us in our ignorance and in our folly. We thank thee for teaching us about fresh grace again, free grace again tonight. Thank thee for this wonderful story of your grace to Jacob. We thank you that you shepherded him all his life long. We thank you that the angel constantly appeared to reassure him, to break him, and to remake him, and to rename him. So break us afresh and rename us afresh, we pray thee, as those willing to let you choose. Thank you for this great privilege. Thank you that goodness and mercy shall follow us all the days of our life if we belong to the Shepherd. Thank you that we have nothing to fear in the future because we can see the past. Enable us then in the silence to accept these things and to rejoice in submission before thy sovereign will and purpose. We ask it through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.